from the Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Harry S. Truman, the 33rd President of the United States, was born on May 8, 1884. He died in 1972. But he might have met an earlier and more tragic death had two Puerto Rican nationalists had their way in November 1950. Our guest this week, Stephen Hunter, has co-authored a book on that assassination attempt titled American Gunfight, The Plot to Kill Harry Truman and the Shootout That Stopped It. He will be speaking with Talking History's Lena Place. And after that, Fiona Beatty will tell us about a film version of President Harry Truman's memoirs. But first, as we do each week, let's look at some items of historical interest in the news that you may have missed. As we've said on several occasions on this show, Americans are obsessed with their lists. So it was with more than a little anticipation that History Channel viewers tuned into that channel's series, 10 Days That Changed America, that aired in early April. The series consisted of 10 documentaries on what were seen as events that triggered, quote, a seismic shift in American political, cultural, or social landscape, as its producers described it. Our purpose here is not to challenge the events included on that list, but rather to call them to your attention and encourage you to view these documentaries, as they will be repeated again in the coming months and made available at the History Channel's website, and to make up your own mind. So, here they are in chronological order. May 27, 1637, the day the English settlers began their engagement in the slaughter of Native Americans at Mystic, Connecticut, in what would be known as the Pequot War. January 25, 1787, the day a violent tax revolt began in western Massachusetts, known for its leader as Shays' Rebellion. The event, many historians believe, led directly to the writing of a new U.S. Constitution. January 24, 1848, the day gold was discovered in California. September 17, 1862, the bloodiest day in American history, the Civil War Battle of Antietam that resulted in 23,000 casualties, but whose Union victory discouraged foreign countries from supporting the Confederacy and encouraged President Abraham Lincoln to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. July 6, 1892, the start of the homestead strike at Andrew Carnegie's steel mill in western Pennsylvania, whose violence significantly strengthened the Union movement in the United States. September 6, 1901, the day President William McKinley was assassinated, bringing President Theodore Roosevelt and the progressive movement to the White House. July 21, 1925, the day the Scopes monkey trial opened in Dayton, Tennessee over the teaching of evolution in the public schools. July 16, 1939, the date of Albert Einstein's letter to President Franklin Roosevelt urging the president to build an atomic bomb. September 9, 1956, when Elvis Presley appeared on The Ed Sullivan Show, signaling the arrival of a new form of American popular culture. And June 24, 1964, the day when three civil rights workers were murdered in Mississippi, prompting national outrage and leading to the passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Well, there you have it. Check out the History Channel's 10 documentaries on what it considers 10 days that changed America and make up your own mind. When we return, Lena Place talks to the author of a new book on an assassination attempt that, if it had succeeded, might have been included on this list. This is Talking History. It's not a well-known event, and among those who are at all familiar with it, the attempted assassination of Harry S. Truman is often seen as being led by two deranged loners who had little chance of succeeding and accomplished very little. But is this an accurate account of the event? Our guest this week, Stephen Hunter, helps set the record straight. He's interviewed by Lena Place.
On a warm November afternoon in 1950, President Harry Truman was aroused from a nap by the sound of gunfire immediately below his window. In an exchange of gunshots that lasted only 38 and a half seconds, two Puerto Rican nationalists were prevented from carrying out their plan to assassinate the President of the United States. In their book, American Gunfight, the plot to kill Harry Truman and the shootout that stopped it. Stephen Hunter and John Bainbridge Jr. have written a riveting account of that day, creating full portraits of all the individuals involved. Stephen Hunter is a film critic at the Washington Post and a winner of the 2003 Pulitzer Prize. He has written 12 novels and 2 collections of film criticism. Welcome, Steve.
It's great to be here.
Thank you. I can recall from my own school days, 8th grade history and beyond, very brief mention of this episode in our various history books, and it was invariably dismissed as a minor event carried out by 2 deranged loners.
If people remember it at all, and when we were looking into this, we were stunned at how many people had never even heard of it. Many people confused it or had it intermingled with another event in 1954. 4 Puerto Rican nationalists broke into Congress and shot the halls of Congress up. They were led by a beautiful woman, and that sort of became the signal event of the awkwardness between the United States and Puerto Rico. But in point of fact, on November 1st, 1950, as you say, far more serious, far graver, far more disturbing episode took place. 2 men tried to kill Harry Truman. 38.5 seconds of gunfight on Pennsylvania Avenue. 2 men dead, 2 men seriously wounded. Harry Truman could have died, and I think all of us agree that the height of the Cold War and the height of the Korean War and the height of the McCarthy era, the death of Harry Truman would have been a grave blow to this country.
What convinced you of the importance of the event? What really got you started writing the book?
I wanted to write a book about a gunfight, and my original idea was to write a novel. What I wanted to do was find a real gunfight and map out the action and use that as a template, and then write a fiction around that. And I had read about this event way back in 1957 when I was 11 years old, and I'd never forgotten it, or at least my subconscious had never forgotten it. And when I was considering gunfights, out of nowhere, this event popped into my mind. So I thought, well, let me look at the standard volume on it and make a decision on that basis, see what is known about it. That's when I discovered, hello, there is no standard volume. So at that point, I realized that I could write the standard volume. Mm-hmm. That was the book that should be written. The only problem was I didn't want to because it was going to be such hard work, so much research. It was at that point I asked a friend of mine, John Bainbridge, a lawyer, former journalist that I'd known from my days on the Baltimore Sun. And John did a remarkable job of research and just worked himself to death digging this stuff out. I wrote the book. I plotted the book. I developed all the characters, found the voice and structure of the book. John did all the heavy spade work, all the heavy digging. I made 5 trips to Puerto Rico. John made 5 trips to the Truman Library. John did most of the interviewing, though I did some of the interviewing with him. But he was a major full-time researcher for 2.5 years.
There were 2 assailants, Oscar Colazzo and Griselio Torresola, and you make it very clear that these 2 men were not operating as loners, but were really part of a larger plot organization.
That was one of the remarkable discoveries we made. That's always been the issue if you look at this event. Were these 2 guys screwballs, or were they part of a larger plot? And we uncovered circumstantial evidence that convinces us, at any rate, that this was indeed a plot hatched at the highest levels of the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party under the auspices of a fiery orator, a guy, a Harvard graduate of all things, named Pedro Albizu Campos, who was an extremely articulate, just a brilliant guy, but he is very angry. I mean, his anger corrupted his life and turned him towards violence. And what he has envisioned was a insurrection in Puerto Rico, the assassination of the governor of Puerto Rico, and the assassination of the president of the United States, all happening simultaneously. And what happened was the very elaborate plot fell apart, and these things happened awkwardly over a space of about 4 or 5 days. Mm. And no one really made the connection, though they suspected it, no one made the connection to the larger plot.
What did they hope to accomplish by assassinating the president?
In one sense, they were modern terrorists in that, and this was Albizu Campos's brilliance. Mm-hmm. He understood that the real battle was a propaganda battle. He understood that before political changes could be made, hearts and minds had to be changed. And he knew that in the United States, where he lived for many years, Puerto Rico was taken for granted. Nobody paid any attention to it. Most people didn't even know where it was. And he wanted something that would put his struggle on the map. And he divined that this would be a blow of lightning significance that would suddenly put Puerto Rico in the issues of Puerto Rican independence and the future of Puerto Rico, make it extremely vivid to the American public.
It's important to remind our listeners, of course, that President Truman was not living in the White House, as our assassins discovered just that day when they went in.
He was actually living in Blair House, which is actually two houses, two Federalist mansions conjoined. They're kitty-corner from the White House on Pennsylvania Avenue. They look like two buildings from the outside. They have two separate entrances, but if you go inside, you're just in one building, and it's a mesh of doorways and stairways and beautiful old furniture, and it's now the official guest residence of the United States. It's where sheiks and ambassadors and heads of state come and stay. But in those days, for a couple of years, Harry Truman and his family lived there.
I think one of the most startling sentences in the book is at the end of the chapter where you describe President Truman as an ordinary person would, being awakened by the sound of gunshots, getting up from his nap, and padding to the open window two stories above and looking out of it.
Bess hated air conditioning, and she wouldn't let any of these buildings be air conditioned. So, in fact, it was a very hot day, and it was 80 degrees even though it was November, and Harry Truman took a nap every day. You know, if anyone deserved a nap, he deserved a nap. He'd gone upstairs. He always took off and hung up his suit. So he was in his underwear. And when the shots awakened him at roughly 2:20 in the afternoon, he was curious. He's from the show me state. He had to see. So he went to the window. And that means there was a moment in this fight where one man, Grisilio Torresola, was a very good shot, who'd already hit and wounded three policemen, stood reloading his pistol while Harry Truman was either at the window or was just about to arrive at the window. 31 feet was the distance. We measured it. And we just don't even like to think what would have happened if Grisilio had seen the President of the United States. And at that point, it wouldn't have mattered whether Grisilio and Oscar got into the house. There was a big deal made of the fact that they didn't get into the house. Given that scenario, they didn't have to get into the house. What happened was one of the men that Grisilio had shot, a wonderful guy named Les Caulfield, a 38-year-old White House policeman, had been shot three times, was slipping off into coma. He pulled himself upright, drew his gun, fired one shot, hit Grisilio behind the ear, killed Grisilio instantly, and then Les slid down back into his chair into coma, and he died an hour later without regaining consciousness.
That's probably one of the most compelling and moving moments.
It was an extraordinary, you know, as a movie critic, I've seen all these phony gunfights, but that was a moment that Hollywood couldn't even plan. And yet it really came down to a dying man taking a shot that could have saved the life of the President of the United States.
Again, going back to the president hanging out an open window, what a long way we've come. I mean, that's unthinkable.
Yeah, it is.
I recall another story of Margaret Truman answering the door one day at Blair House.
I think what that signifies is the absence of paranoia in the universe. And in fact, all the Secret Service precautions were the men were great. Please don't misconstrue this as criticism of the men of the Secret Service. But the plans were very casual. The guys were just standing around. They had guard posts. They had to stand at these guard posts for a long time in the hot sun. And as men's minds will, theirs wandered. So there was really very little security. And every single one of them performed admirably, brilliantly, and heroically. But the original plan of Grisilio's was to attack the dwelling with five armed men. And if they had done that, they very easily would have overwhelmed the Secret Service, and the Alvin Barkley era would have begun that afternoon.
You talk quite a bit about the Secret Service and make the point that about that time that the culture, as you call it, was beginning to change, the kind of men, and they were men, who were guarding the president. It was a different set of characters who was coming to play.
In those days, Secret Service men were or at least before the war and during the war, they were drawn almost totally from former state policemen. And they were tough guys, well-trained guys, but they were motorcycle cops. They had a lot of experience. They'd done a lot of arrest work. They'd done investigative work. And they were what you call street smart. But they were probably... they were a little cruder, a little rougher, and the head of the Secret Service sort of understood that the times were changing. And in the 50s, in the late 40s and the 50s, he began to, if I may say so, I don't want to say upgrade, because that's not the quite word, but he wanted smoother people. And so he began to recruit from colleges. And many of the people who came into the Secret Service had not been police officers. They were graduates of something new in American education, which was departments of criminal justice. Many of them, one of the men there in that fight, Vince Moraz, was in fact a graduate of the University of Michigan School of Criminal Justice. He'd never been a state policeman. He'd gone straight into the Secret Service. He'd really only been in the Secret Service a couple of years when he found himself in this gunfight.
Do you think the impact of television had something to do with that, how these fellows
appeared? That's probably a very good surmise. Of course, we'll never know. I also think that sort of the era of the self-educated man was coming. You know, just generally in American society, college was being opened up to more and more people, and the college experience, which had been relatively rare before the war, was becoming much more the norm. And in that respect, the Secret Service reflected those same ideas as did other aspects of government and, for that matter, private industry.
You talk about President Truman, Harry Truman, in a sense, having a vision of himself as two persons, Harry the man and Harry the president. Did those two individuals respond differently to this attack on the...
And one of the problems was Harry the man went to the window instead of Harry the president. Mm-hmm. And Harry the man should have said to Harry the president, get down. But Harry the president was still asleep, and Harry the man said, let's see what's happening at the window. I will say this about Harry Truman. We've spoken extensively to Secret Service people who served him, and they loved him. He was a really good guy. He was involved with them. He visited them when they were in the hospital. He gave them Christmas presents. It was just sort of part of his decency, and I think all the men who fought in that fight were extremely glad that they'd been there and that they'd done their duty that day.
After the assassination of President Kennedy, which was only 13 years later, it seems like much longer than that, there was a very public sort of soul-searching on the part of the Secret Service. What had they done wrong? What did they need to do to change? Did the same sort of thing have to happen after this attempt on Truman's
life?
You know
what? Not really. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's remarkable to us, particularly in the modern age, beginning with the Kennedy assassination, but ever since then, every time something remarkable happens in the body politic, we study it. We hold hearings on it. We appoint a blue ribbon panel. We try and understand its lessons. We try and learn for something. But all that really started with the Kennedy assassination. And what stunned us in looking into this particular event was how it was never really studied, how the investigation was very narrow, how it never managed to uncover the larger conspiracy, how no panels were convened, there were no hearings held, there were no separate investigations by outside bodies. The Secret Service investigated itself, very cursory investigation. And the other thing was that although they made certain very specific changes in keeping the president, his access to the public and the public's access to him, and limiting that, clearly they never really sort of connected with the idea of conspiracy in the universe. And that may have left Kennedy vulnerable 13 years later. It's hard to say. I think they should have learned more than they did. There are all kinds of also tactical, technical issues that they should have learned about from this episode that the bureaucracy had too much inertia to really study and alter its ways.
Let's talk a little bit about how you wrote the book. It's very fast-paced, and if it were a novel, we'd be talking about character development. You really focus on the people.
Thank you very much. Some of the critics, you know, we find that many of the people who review the book are historians, and some of them even go so far as to say that we spend too much time looking at marginal people. Well, to us, there are no marginal people. We're storytellers, and we want these guys to come alive. We want you to know who the assassins are. We want you to know what created them. We want you to know what their belief systems are. We want you to see them as the way they saw themselves. And at the same time, we want you to know the domestic situations, the personal histories, the biographies of the Secret Service and the White House police personnel. Because when we finally put you in the gunfight, we want you to really care about who lives and who dies. They're not just figures. You know, they're just not stick figures to us. We want it to be a human drama as much as a historical drama. And so we did try very hard to get at the intimate details of these lives, the intimate details of workplace culture. And, you know, I consider myself not a historian, but a storyteller. Mm-hmm. And I want, first and foremost, I want this to be a great story. And I'm much more interested in that than that it be the last word on Harry Truman or the last word on Puerto Rican nationalism or the last word on presidential security. What I want it to do is to be a great American story.
We've got time for one more question. It's impossible, really, to read your account without being aware of words such as zealot and the willingness to kill and to be killed and not think of the daily news reports that we hear now.
That's a very good point. However, I will say that there was something, and this is controversial. A lot of people are very angry at us for coming to this conclusion, but these guys, these two men, Oscar and Gracilio, were, as you say, different than the usual twisted loner with grudges and distorted versions of reality. They believed in the morality of what they were doing. They understood that they were sacrificing their lives. They saw themselves as soldiers. They were not the kind of men who would fly an airliner full of children into a building full of stockbrokers. That was beyond them. That would have horrified them. They attacked other armed professionals, and they shot it out with armed professionals, and they were willing to take the consequences. And in fact, one of them survived. Oscar survived. His attorneys begged him to plead insanity. He refused to plead insanity. He insisted on using his trial to make his political points. He understood that he would get the death penalty. He still did it. It just so happened that Harry Truman commuted the sentence. He spent 26 years in prison. But he did this because he believed in it politically and logically, not because he was crazy.
The presidency of Harry Truman set the agenda for the second half of the 20th century. Had the two would-be assassins been successful, that agenda and the volatile state of international affairs would have been dramatically affected. We've been talking to Stephen Hunter, author of American Gunfight, The Plot to Kill Harry Truman. Thank you, Steve.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for a great interview.
This is Talking History.
I'm just wild about Harry, and Harry's wild about me. The heavenly blisses of his kiss.
Continuing on the subject of Harry Truman, Talking History's Fiona Beattie joins us to tell us about a collection of screen gems on the 33rd president available at the Truman Presidential Library.
In 1961, film crews arrived at the Harry S. Truman Library to shoot a film version of the former president's memoirs. The resulting film, Decision, The Conflicts of Harry S. Truman, drew on interviews with family, friends, colleagues, formal and informal interviews with Truman. The Screen Gems collection, named for the film company, available at the Harry S. Truman Library website, consists of outtakes from the film series. There is an extensive searchable finding aid, which includes brief text descriptions. The collection consists of 3 hours of film and 26 hours of audio. So far, Ray Gesselbracht, special assistant to the director, spoke to me about some of his favorite audio clips and gave some insight into the collection.
President Truman is oftentimes speaking off the script, and saying some things that just simply aren't usable in the program. But oftentimes, they're very revealing of both President Truman as a person and of his administration. He's revealing a few new things about himself on these interview tapes, and he's also saying a few things that are a little different than we've heard before about his presidency.
And on the amusing side, Ray revealed an insightful anecdote.
One of the things that researchers will see is that President Truman never sits still. And I think that this energy that you see was a mark of his presidency. He's in a desk chair, and he just goes back and forth in it, back and forth, wiggling back and forth. At one point, the producer says, Mr. President, will you stop swinging back and forth in that chair because you're going out of the frame of the camera? And President Truman says, oh, yes, of course, I'll do that. Well, over 2 years of filming, he never stopped wiggling back and forth in the chair.
What makes the outtakes so interesting is that Truman is speaking off script.
I've brought two clips with me to give you some idea about what this collection is like. The first clip concerns President Truman's decision to recognize Israel in 1948. He's talking without a script here, and he likens himself to the referee in a wrestling match. And this explains something about how President Truman felt in the months leading up to his decision to recognize Israel.
There they were on both sides. There I was in the middle, between both sides. I was in the position of the referee in a prize ring when the two big wrestlers turn on the referee instead of going ahead with the wrestling. I was in real trouble.
The second clip is a little different and shows a more personal side of President Truman, as many of the clips in this collection do. In this clip, he talks about an offer that he got just after his presidency ended, and it was an offer to sit on a board of directors and receive $100,000 a year.
By the way, the squeaking noise is Harry S. Truman's chair.
I had offers from, half a dozen people who wanted to pay me a great big salary. One in particular told me that he would like to give me $100,000 a year to be chairman of a board of his organization. And I said to him, why didn't you make that offer to me when I was working out on the farm for 10 years? I'd have been happy to have it. And then he left. He knew very well where I'd put him. He was trying to exploit the presidency of the United States, and that I wouldn't stand for.
Ray has worked on this project for over 17 years, and it's still ongoing. You can visit online, and of course, in person is even better. For more information, go to trumanlibrary.org.
And that's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OEH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need to do is visit our website at oeh.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thank you for listening. This is your host, Brian Laveau.